An ominous warning for possible Russian attacks on civilian shipping in the Black Sea.
It's just unbelievable. It is, you know, the modern day word would be terrorism, but it's piracy is what it is.
Plus, disenchanted Kenyans protesting the high cost of living paralyzed businesses in Nairobi.
We've been open since almost 4 hours and no customers, no work at all. Yeah, no movement of cars, no people.
And a shooting in Auckland, hours ahead of its hosting the opening of the Women's World Cup. Today is Thursday, July 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. 2 days after withdrawing from a safe passage deal that threatens to worsen global food supplies, Russia is warning that ships sailing to Ukraine's Black Sea ports will be seen as potential military targets. Associated Press correspondent Lisa Dwyer reports.
The White House is warning that the Russian military is preparing for possible attacks on civilian shipping vessels in the Black Sea. That warning comes days after Russia suspended participation in a wartime deal that allowed grain to flow from Ukraine to countries around the world. Since leaving the Black Sea grain deal, Russia has already struck Ukraine's grain export ports in Odessa with missile and drone attacks. The Russian Defense Ministry has declared international waters in northwestern and southeastern parts of the Black Sea temporarily dangerous for shipping. The ministry says it will see any incoming vessel as laden with military cargo. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb got reaction from former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Kurt Volker.
What do you expect to happen? And is that acceptable?
Well, it is completely unacceptable. Russia has no right to threaten flag third-party vessels in international waters in the Black Sea. The U.S. Navy, U.S. Marines, and the British and the Dutch, we have all stood for the principle of freedom of navigation for commercial vessels, really since the beginning of the time the U.S. Navy was founded. And for Russia just to come out and say that any vessel that it decides it wants to attack, it's going to attack, that is the equivalent of piracy. And we have to speak up against this.
And do you think it holds any teeth?
I think it's quite possible. I think that they would try to attack one ship and try to make an example to then dissuade anyone else from attempting to land in the Ukrainian ports and do any shipping.
Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Kurt Volker. Russia's decision to pull out of the Black Sea grain deal has humanitarian aid groups deeply concerned about how this will impact global food insecurity for some of the world's most vulnerable people. USAID Chief Samantha Power, visiting Ukraine this week, spoke from the port of Odessa, where she called on the world to speak out against Moscow's blockade.
I think countries and leaders near and far should be condemning publicly the decision to withdraw from an initiative that was all about getting food out of Ukraine to the rest of the world. Two-thirds of the wheat that came out of the Black Sea Grain Initiative export channel went to developing countries. That is an enormous amount of wheat, and I saw firsthand in places like Somalia, Kenya, and Lebanon over the course of the last year just how dependent those economies are on the import of Ukrainian wheat. So, you know, this is not a time for countries to stand back and lament this development. This is a chance for them to come out publicly or, better yet, engage Russian diplomats on the cost of this decision for global food prices.
For further insight on what humanitarian aid groups are anticipating, I spoke with Anne Gorella, Regional Director of Operations for the nonprofit Action Against Hunger.
The collapse of the grain deal is quite a worrisome news for an organization like Action Against Hunger. We are concerned that this is going to have an impact on food prices, on food commodities worldwide, and that the poorest countries are going to be the most affected. That's the first consequences we are expecting from the collapse of the grain deal. The second consequence that we are fearing is resuming of military operation in the areas surrounding Odessa and the Black Sea. Until now, the Grand Deal operated like a de facto ceasefire in the region around Odessa and the Black Sea. So we are expecting that warfare is going to increase, and we are quite concerned about the fate of civilian population living in this area.
Hunger has become quite an issue globally with inflation prices, drought, climate change. I understand you just released a report on your organization's assessment of where things are globally with the issue of hunger. It's very worrisome.
It is, indeed. It is a very worrisome situation. And the collapse of the grain deal just comes on top of previous factors and previous situation that have unfolded. Just looking back 2 years ago, we had the COVID pandemic, which was also quite critical for people and their livelihoods. So there has been a huge loss of revenues and wages across the planet. But this has been hitting harder on the poorest population in the Southern Hemisphere. You were mentioning climate change. It is already having a dramatic impact on food production. And now the Grain Deal is going to add an extra layer of complication with prices soaring up. So hunger is not only a matter of empty stomachs. It's also a matter of very complex issues being intricated at the political level, at the economical level, and the collapse of the grain deal is just adding an extra layer of complication to address food insecurity across the world.
What do you say to the fact that food and hunger seem to be becoming more and more of a sort of political weapon?
This is very true. We're saying that since last year, it's more than 122 million more people who are suffering from hunger. And hunger becomes, and access to food becomes now a weapon of war. So we, and I'm not only talking about Ukraine and Russia, we're also seeing the situation in numerous countries where we are working. And we are seeing that belligerents are using access to food insurance, access to markets as weapon of war. There have been blockages, road blockages, there have been farmers have been chased from their lands. And this is a warfare technique that belligerents are using to reduce the capacity of communities to be resilient in the face of conflict.
Ann Gorella, Regional Director of Operations for the nonprofit Action Against Hunger. A gunman killed two people at a construction site in Auckland, New Zealand, as the nation prepared to host the games in the FIFA Women's World Cup soccer tournament. The shooter is also dead. Police said the shooting on one of the busy streets in the city center was an isolated incident and not a national security risk. We're following these other stories from around the world. The U.S. has suspended federal funding to China's Wuhan Institute of Virology for biosafety protocol violations at the facility that has faced questions for years over the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Italy put 23 cities on red alert Wednesday as it reckoned with another day of scorching temperatures with no sign of relief as a collision of extreme heat, wildfire, and flooding incidents have wreaked havoc and increased the risk of death from the United States to China. The Pakistani Taliban released an online magazine geared toward women this week. The militant group is staging a resurgence with near daily deadly attacks on Pakistani security forces. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Earth's core is made up of two layers, its liquid outer core, made mostly of iron, and a solid sphere-shaped inner core. Many think the inner core has an absolutely smooth surface, but a new study led by researchers at the University of Utah suggests that it is scattered with iron grains as it expands into the outer core, giving it a kind of textured look. According to the study, these grains chronicle the growth of the inner core and may change over geologic time due to geodynamic forces. The study's authors made their findings by analyzing seismic wave data from nearly 2,500 earthquakes, all surpassing a magnitude of 5.7. The data was generated by the International Monitoring System, a global network of stations that is being set up to detect nuclear blasts. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Israeli President Isaac Herzog marked the 75th year of Israeli independence Wednesday in an address to the U.S. Congress. His visit to Washington comes amid concerns about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's controversial judicial overhaul plan and Israel's continuing conflict with the Palestinians. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Israeli President Isaac Herzog in Washington addressing Congress at a key point in the U.S.-Israel relationship, telling lawmakers Iran is the greatest threat to the two countries.
Iran is building nuclear capabilities that pose a threat to the stability of the Middle East and beyond.
Herzog's visit comes amid conflict over ongoing construction in West Bank Jewish settlements, a move Herzog defended, saying Israel would not discuss peace while threatened by terrorists.
True peace cannot be anchored in violence.
Earlier this month, Hezbollah leader Saeed Hassan Nasrallah said Lebanese land under the control of Israel must be liberated.
This is Lebanese land. The Israelis reoccupied it. Not only reoccupied it, but fenced it off and built a wall.
Prior to the address, some members of Congress expressed concern about the Israeli government's treatment of Palestinians. Herzog said denial of the Jewish state is anti-Semitism, but recognized there is room for criticism.
A new generation of Israelis and Americans are assuming leadership roles, a generation that was not privy to the hardship of Israel's formative years. A generation that is less engaged in the roots that connect our peoples. A generation that perhaps takes for granted the U.S.-Israel relationship.
Herzog also addressed massive ongoing protests over Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to revise Israel's judicial system, which many see as a move towards authoritarianism.
The intense debate going on back home, even as we speak, is the clearest tribute to the fortitude of Israel's democracy. Israel's democracy has always been based on free and fair elections, on honoring the people's choice, on safeguarding minority rights, on protection of human and civil liberties, and on a strong and independent judiciary.
A representative of Reform Judaism in the U.S. told VOA the removal of checks and balances in the Israeli government is a cause for concern.
It's incredibly problematic what this prime minister and his incredibly problematic coalition has proposed. They want to do everything from change the way that judges are selected so that they could handpick their judges to, in essence, ending judicial review.
U.S. President Joe Biden has invited Netanyahu to visit the United States this fall. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. officials scrambled on Wednesday to determine the fate of an American soldier who made an unauthorized crossing into North Korea, handing Washington a new crisis in its dealings with the nuclear-armed state. North Korea stayed silent Wednesday about its detention of the soldier. We hear more from VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane.
No fire appeared to have been exchanged at the high-tension border town of Panmunjom, where soldiers from the two Koreas stand guard every day facing each other. At the Pentagon, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was asked about reports of an American soldier who on Tuesday crossed the border into North Korea.
One of our service members who was on a tour willfully and without authorization crossed the military demarcation line. We believe that he is in the BRK custody. And so we're closely monitoring and investigating the situation and working to notify the soldiers next of kin and engaging to address this incident. In terms of my concerns, I'm absolutely foremost concerned about the welfare of our troops.
The facts are not yet clear in this case. The State Department said Defense Department officials have been in touch with officials from North Korea to resolve the situation. The incident comes at a time of heightened tensions between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States, says Eric Gomez, is with the Cato Institute. He spoke to VOA via Zoom. doom.
This week before this happened, the big story was the United States was sending a ballistic missile submarine to visit the port of Busan for the first time, again, since the early 1980s, I believe since 82.
The United States sent the nuclear-armed submarine to South Korea after repeated North Korean missile launches, including two on Wednesday. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The first of a planned 3 days of protests in Kenya over the high cost of living and recent government tax hikes paralyzed parts of Nairobi Wednesday. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariana Diallo visited the Kenyan capital's central business district and has the story.
Protesters burned tires and battled with police in many places across the country on the first day of nationwide protests called by opposition leader Raila Odinga. Primary and secondary day schools were closed in the capital, Nairobi, and Mombasa. In Nairobi's Kibera district, Omondi Jaisian says he's ready to protest as long as it takes.
I'm protesting because the standards of living in this country have gone drastically up. They are going up each and every day. We don't need Dutra, that's it. He has already shown us he's a very stubborn man. He's not ready to listen to the people.
In the usually bustling central business district in downtown Nairobi, most businesses were closed, but a few people decided to open shop. Local resident Vikita Hirani works at Brand X Limited, a shop that sells men's clothing.
We thought the morning hours there will nothing be serious, so we just came to see what's happening around. But we've been open since almost 4 hours and no customers, no work at all. Yeah, no movement of cars, no people.
Another resident drives a so-called matatu, a common mode of public transportation. He says usually he can fill his van quickly, but today he's been waiting for a while because there are no customers.
I've come to work today because I don't have money. Landlord is waiting for me. Children, I have a family.
Next to him, Wilson Yorogi urged Kenyan President William Ruto and opposition leader Odinga to negotiate.
They should call each other, talk, and come to a conclusion. They stop what they are doing. Because we are the ones who are affected.
The opposition group Azimio called for the protest in part because of tax hikes passed last month by the Ruto government. The rate hike has since been challenged in court. Vincent Kimosop, an economic policy and governance expert based in Nairobi, explains.
The Chief Justice yesterday has appointed a 3-judge bench to listen to this. So you can see clearly that if we leverage on the legal and institutional frameworks that facilitates us to address our grievances.
Javis Bigambo is a lawyer and governance specialist based in Nairobi, he says President Ruto should exercise prudence.
The president needs not play critical hardball with especially his opponents, Raila Odinga, because the opposition and with Raila Odinga, they're inviting the president to the table of chaos. The president should not take the bait. The president should also see how to separately handle the socio-economic necessities that are the driving force of the present demonstrations, especially issues to do with the cost of living, which has been taken advantage of by the opposition, and they are now spiraling.
Kenyan Foreign Minister Alfred Mutua says the protests have been politically instigated and have been far from peaceful as the opposition have characterized them.
What we have witnessed are violent protests with those involved carrying all manner of crude weapons. We have seen goons destroy a highway with no police around. That is not a peaceful protest.
The protests are expected to continue Thursday. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And as we mentioned earlier in the program, the Women's Soccer World Cup is kicking off in New Zealand and Australia on Thursday. More than 1 million tickets have been sold for the 64 games. FIFA, the sport's international governing body, believes it will be the most watched women's soccer tournament. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
32 nations will take part in the World Cup, co-hosted by Australia and New Zealand. In 1991, when the event was first held, there were just 12 teams. The United States is the defending champion and hopes to become the first team to win the trophy 3 times in a row. With matches as far apart as Perth in Western Australia to the New Zealand capital Wellington, this tournament will be like no other in terms of distances. Ireland, for example, will travel 8,000 kilometres in the group stage alone. But as the tournament prepares to start, there is controversy over the competition's prize money. The winners of the Men's World Cup receive $440 million, but for women, the prize is $110 million. The Australian women's national team, known as the Matildas, released a video Monday to complain about the disparity and lack of an equal prize. Midfield player Tamika Yallop said while the Matildas have some of the same rights as Australia's men's team, the Socceroos, there's still inequality.
Collective bargaining has allowed us to ensure we now get the same conditions as the Socceroos, with one exception. FIFA will still only offer women one quarter as much prize money as men for the same achievement.
Soccer is Australia's most popular sport in terms of participation. There's a feeling among former players and supporters that New Zealand and Australia are hosting the tournament at a pivotal time for women's football. Its profile has never been higher, and arguably the standards never better. Kate Gill is a former Matildas captain and co-chief executive at Professional Footballers Australia, the players' union. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that she hopes the tournament will encourage fans to also support Australia's domestic competitions.
There's going to be a number of young boys and girls that are really going to fall in love with the game and want to get involved in football. And we do have two domestic codes, both the A-League men and the A-League women. They are crying out for some love in that respect. So if we could kind of transition that enthusiasm and fans could start showing up in support of that, I think that would be the big call out from this World Cup.
The highest ranked country going into the World Cup is the United States, followed by Germany, Sweden, England and France. Co-hosts Australia are ranked 10th by FIFA, while New Zealand is 26th. The opening match will be between New Zealand and Norway at Eden Park in Auckland on July 20. A few hours later in Sydney, Australia plays Ireland. The final will take place in Australia a month later at Sydney's Olympic Stadium on August 20. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nearly 110,000 Americans died last year of a drug overdose. Two-thirds of those deaths involved synthetic opioids. For the individuals, the families, the communities affected, the pain caused by these deaths and by the millions who suffer with substance use is immeasurable, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the recently concluded virtual ministerial meeting to launch the Global Coalition to Address Synthetic Drugs. That's why President Biden has made it a top priority for the United States to tackle two of the critical drivers of this epidemic in the United States: untreated addiction and drug trafficking. America is far from alone in facing this challenge, noted Secretary Blinken.
According to the United Nations, more than 34 million people around the world use methamphetamines or other synthetic stimulants annually.
Every region is experiencing an alarming rise in other synthetic drugs. In Africa, it's tramadol. In the Middle East, fake Captagon pills. In Asia, ketamine, added Secretary Blinken. The criminal organizations that traffic synthetic drugs are extremely adept at exploiting weak links in our interconnected global system. When one government aggressively restricts the precursor chemical, traffickers simply buy it elsewhere. When one country closes off a transit route, traffickers quickly shift to another. This is why we are creating this global coalition, said Secretary Blinken, with three key areas of focus.
First, preventing the illicit manufacture and trafficking of synthetic drugs. Second, detecting emerging threats and patterns of use. And third, advancing public health interventions and services to prevent and reduce drug use, to save lives, to support recovery for people who use drugs.
At every step, our focus will be on developing practical policies, said Secretary Blinken.
We need to partner with the private sector, including chemical manufacturers, shipping companies, social media platforms, because this illicit trade is built on the pillars of legitimate global commerce. Most synthetic drugs are produced from chemicals that are used legally in making pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, household products.
In addition, traffickers advertise synthetic drugs on social media. They use online apps to communicate with prospective buyers and collect payments. This coalition, said Secretary Blinken, is about protecting our citizens' security, their health, their prosperity. It's also about saving people's lives, saving their futures, people who could be our neighbors, our friends, our loved ones.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.